Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to The Economist Asks. I'm Anne McElvoy, and this week we're asking, comedy, taboos and free speech, where's the line? My guest is Ricky Gervais. He's an award-winning stand-up comedian, actor, writer, producer and director. He achieved international success with his TV series The Office. That mockumentary about the hapless boss David Brent was remade for audiences in America, Sweden, France, Germany and Brazil, proving that bad management is an international phenomenon.
Right, that is it.
Slow down, you move too fast. Solomon's here. All part of the job. What's going on?
Put my stapler inside a jelly again. That's the third time he's done it. It wasn't even funny the first time.
Why has he done that?
Just told him once that I don't like jelly. Don't trust the way it moves.
Yeah, you showed him a weakness. He pounced. You should know about that.
He's won more awards than would fit on most mantelpieces, including BAFTAs, Emmys and Golden Globes. Ricky then hosted the Globes for 4 years and managed to upset Mel Gibson, Robert Downey Jr. and Caitlyn Jenner with his jokes along the way. His latest series is a 6-part dark comedy for Netflix, Afterlife. It follows Tony struggling to come to terms with the death of his wife.
Why don't you throw yourself into your work, okay? That's what depressed people do sometimes.
It's hard for me to throw myself into my work when my work is often talking to a plumber on the estate who's grown a potato that looks like Lionel Richie. That made the front cover.
It did look like him, though.
You know what, actually, this is a good time. We've got quite a lot of exciting leads at the moment.
Leads?
Yeah.
Like with Woodward and Bernstein.
Yeah, they are leads.
Go on, what leads?
All right.
Do we
so
have?
A woman called in the other day. When she drags her dustbin, it sounds like Chewbacca.
No.
After contemplating suicide, he chooses life, but his coping strategy is to do or say whatever he wants, no matter what the consequences may be. Ricky Gervais, welcome to The Economist Asks.
Hello.
Lovely to have you along.
My pleasure.
Afterlife is a comedy which is distilled, I think, from a mix which you could describe as death, grief, suicide, drugs, old age, dementia features
funny
as
stuff,
well.
Right?
It's very funny, isn't it? What is funny about those things at the extremes of human experience?
I don't know they're funny per se, but you can certainly look at them from a funny way. And I think that humour is to get us over bad stuff. You know, in my stand-up, I often include real anecdotes about what happened at my mum's funeral or my dad's funeral. And I explain it in terms of, you know, it's what they would have wanted and it's a coping mechanism and life carries on. And I think the humour from classically a misanthrope, I suppose, comes from him not being happy with his lot. I mean, there's two, you know, David Brent, it was the opposite. We laughed at the blind spot. You know, we thought he was thankfully out of his misery because he didn't know we were laughing at him. We laughed at the difference between how he saw himself and how we saw him. And that's one way of doing it. Whereas with this character, they do know where they stand and what their life's like, and they're not happy. And comedy is usually a regular guy or girl trying to do something they're not equipped to do. So actually, we feel sorry for him. We know why he's acting like that. It's a good theory. He treats it like a superpower. But what he's trying to do is feel better.
And that's what's eluding him.
He's not feeling better. He tries everything. He tries to hurt people's feelings, to punish the world. He tries to turn himself into a psychopath so he doesn't feel anymore. But he's not a psychopath. He's a decent man who lost everything, who put all his eggs in one basket. He didn't have a network of friends and work because he didn't care. He couldn't wait to get home to his wife. He wanted 50 years with her and he was denied it. And it was very important to me that I made the relationship real. It's not a coffee advert. They're not people talking to each other like they've just met or it's Valentine's Day. They're getting drunk together every night because they love each other more than anything. You know what I mean? It's a real relationship. And so the balance of what he lost and his grief was really important. So we understood.
You sound quite upset about him, actually.
Oh, it'd be terrible. It'd be a terrible place to be. Because it's also about when you've got a great life and you're happy in your head, nothing matters. But when you're not happy in your own head, it doesn't matter what's happening in the real world. It doesn't matter if the sun's out. It doesn't matter if you've got a nice job. It doesn't matter. You're in pain. And he's an animal with a thorn in his paw. And he's angry, you know. And he's just trying stuff. He's just trying stuff. And deep down, he doesn't want to end it all, I don't think. But living hurts him. And he just wants it to be better.
Your character, Tony, likens his self-destructiveness to a superpower.
Yeah.
I couldn't help wondering whether writing it is a kind of superpower for you, because you're able to go into all these territories and you've just
That's
laid
exactly
out
right.
eloquently.
Yeah.
It must feel a bit like being liberated.
Being a writer-director, you know, we create our own heroes and villains as role play for the soul, and no one really gets hurt. So you can try all those things that happen in real life and no one really gets hurt. But you feel the same. You cry at sad things and you laugh at funny things. But it's a fiction, and you can perfect the real world. You can have all the realism, but then, unlike the real world, you can reward goodness and punish bad behaviour. I suppose we live vicariously through his freedom. Not that it's doing him any good, not that we'd swap places with him, but
it's interesting you talk about him as him, but in some way, you know, you sound very close to him. You've invented this character, you've lived with him for long enough.
Yeah.
But are there then aspects of your own character, obviously not in this dire situation that he's in, but are there bits of this and this desire to just go and tell the world to go to hell?
Well,
are you?
I think everyone should tell the truth. And the reason we don't tell the truth is because we want to be popular, or we don't want to hurt people's feelings, or we worry about the consequences. You know, the mugging scene, without giving anything away, if we're mugged, we hand over our money because we don't want to get hurt, or we've got a baby in a stroller, or they know where we live. We worry about the consequences. So with Tony, he says, I don't care about the consequences. Bring it on. Now, that's exciting. The children's menu scene. That happened to me in real life. In real life, of course, when I said, I'll have a fish fingers and beans, the waitress said, that's a children's menu. I went, oh, okay, I'll have a cheese on toast. But in here, I can put that right.
You get to eat all those fish fingers, that double portion of $5.95
exactly.
fish fingers.
Yes, exactly. Even though they were vegan fingers. I can say, the kid with me who played my nephew, I could tell he wasn't really enjoying these fish fingers.
So that brings us to the lines around comedy, free speech, what's taboo. It's probably a word you raise your eyes to heaven when you're asked, but do you believe there are still taboos in comedy?
Well, it depends. I think people often get offended when they mistake the subject of a joke with the actual target. And that's the important thing. What is the joke? Where's the joke landing? Who's the butt of the joke? What's really the butt of the joke? What are we really saying by the joke? Who's really offended? So there's no subject you shouldn't talk about. It depends on the joke. Like, there's no subject you wouldn't ask me a question about. It depends on the answer. It depends how it's discussed. And I think people assume that if something's in comedy, we're making fun of the subject, as opposed to it could be anti something or pro something.
You've led with your chin, though, haven't you? So what would be a question that I would ask you that you would consider? Would there be taboos around that, for instance?
Well, only in the sense that I might say, well, that's my business, or that's private, or I don't think it's your right to know it. It's your right to ask it. And that's all I'm doing with comedy. I'm asking questions. I'm not telling them how they should feel. That you have got every right to laugh, be disgusted, walk out. I'm just saying it's my right to say it. That's all I'm saying. But if you listen, you'll probably find it's okay. It's okay, because when someone says to me, that's offensive, I want to say, well, actually, no, what you mean is you found it offensive. There's nothing intrinsically offensive about this thing, only emotion. And then when they say, I was offended by that, I want to say, well, why? You've got to formulate an argument here. And often I go, well, you shouldn't talk about that. I go, well, why? People discuss
things. Well, let's give you an example. It is actually from Afterlife. And it was probably just one of the really, I think the only thing that really jarred a bit with me was normalising the use of the C word when it's directed towards a child in a scene it's just very funny. Yeah. But I suppose I'm of a generation of women and perhaps feminists who've thought about this a bit and just sort of wonder why it's everywhere and is that okay?
Well, it's not that it's okay. It's two different things here, because it's one where this is a fiction, it's a character doing it, and we know he's trying to hurt people's feelings. I think we have to talk of it outside afterlife to have a decent discussion about it. In the real world, is it okay? Well, again, it depends. I don't use that word, and I explain this to Americans all the time on Twitter. I don't use it with any misogyny. In fact, I don't think I'd ever use it against a woman. I use it sometimes even as a term of endearment or to show how someone is despicable. I don't think it's the strongest word either. In fact, I think I don't think it goes far enough in some places. It would be inappropriate to call Hitler the C word. It wouldn't be enough. So it's all relative. It depends. And you're right. It's inappropriate to call a 10-year-old boy that word. But Tony's not being appropriate.
And does that mean, when you think about these things, when it sounds like that, you've structured an argument around it, whether I kind of agree with you or not, you have an answer to that.
And that's the other thing about comedy. I think people sometimes think that a comedian goes out and tries to say what they want and hurt people's feelings. It's ridiculous. Those routines are honed. By the time someone sees a routine that I've done on Netflix, I've tested that to about 800,000 people. I've looked at it from every angle. I've made it bulletproof. I can justify any joke I've ever made, and I can tell them what the target is as opposed to what just the subject is.
The first of the 800,000 is from your girlfriend, isn't it? Because you often run stuff past her. And I think you once said, I run it past her for a joke, and if she says, please don't say that in public, I know it's good.
Well, when she says, please don't say that, she's worried about the backlash. So she's worried about how I'll be perceived and the stick I get. And then we discuss it, and we just make sure that the joke is justified, whatever people think. Because if everyone in the world thought the joke was offensive or didn't get it, then there's something wrong with the joke. But that's just not true. It shows the subjective nature of jokes and morality. So what I meant was, just because you're offended, it doesn't mean you're right. Some people are offended by equality. What are we to do about that? Well, we're to ignore them.
Free speech is obviously very important to you.
It is. It's a privilege. It's amazing.
In this context of humour, but also beyond it, you've tweeted about free speech being limited. It's a question we tend to come back to just quite a lot on this show, on both sides of the Atlantic at the moment, because there's something in the air that feels like it might be encroaching on it. How worried do you feel about that, broadly?
We have to push back and protect it. And also, free speech is constrained. It has many caveats, and I agree with. I don't think you should be able to say anything you want, because I agree with libel, and I agree with slander, and I agree with food packaging, and I agree with watersheds. But what I don't agree with is someone thinking you mustn't say something because they don't like it. That's what I don't agree with. And if you don't agree with freedom of speech for people who you don't agree with, you don't agree with freedom of speech.
So that would, and I'm going to take you into an area, something you joked about in the past that caused a bit of a fuss, and that was the Caitlyn Jenner, Bruce Jenner, was around the transgender, and how, you know, could you have a joke using their previously assigned gender to make the joke. It's in the news again in a different form this week, which is why I refer to it, but that's a joke you would stand by.
It is, every step of the way. The joke I did at the Golden Globes, where I say, Caitlyn Jenner, what a hero for... I can't remember that word.
Testing your memory now.
She broke down stereotypes and bravely smashed down barriers. She didn't do a lot for women drivers. So the joke there is about this person's behaviour.
But it was also about her previous gender assignment.
It goes like this. The actual joke goes like this. Oh, yeah, I come out, I go, relax, I'm going to be nice tonight. I've changed. Not as much as Bruce Jenner. Now Caitlyn, of course. So that gets me into the joke. And I discuss this in Humanity, and I say that I deadnamed her, and I hadn't heard of that term anymore, and you can't deadname them, but that's ludicrous. She was called Bruce Jenner. Why? Carry on.
The reason that I brought that up now in the context, just at the time we're interviewing you, is a column written on transgender and transgender in sport by a Times columnist this week, where people complained to Twitter about it. And Twitter then took this complaint rather seriously and said, well, we're not going to don't think this time, but it had that undertone that the social media platforms are getting a bit more onerous around this sort of thing. Is this something we need to push back against, or do we accept it because it's a taste question?
It depends. I think they were banning people for refusing to use the preferred pronouns. If someone wants to be called he or she, I'll do it. But I also agree with someone's right who doesn't want to be told what pronouns to use. I'll do it because I'm quite a polite chap and it's not the hill to die on. If you want to be called he, fine, I'll call you he. I don't care. I don't care enough. But should people be imprisoned for misgendering? No, they shouldn't.
We're talking here in London. This is going out internationally, and this is one of the reasons why a lot of top talent in film and comedy are using the streaming services now, making this sort of content first and foremost to go out on streaming services. Do you think this means that our kind of slightly grim British humour, and I would say your character Tony in Afterlife, as well as his other traumas, got a big dose of quite British sense of humour, does it travel differently now that we're all watching the same shows?
No, I think I've found it when I do my stand-up, I don't have to change anything outside cultural references. I wouldn't talk about the winner of Britain's Big Brother in America, but I'm dealing with bigger subjects. So when I'm talking about world issues, everyone gets them. Obviously, if they speak English, which everyone at my gigs do, and there's a lot of people in the world that speak English. It's the same. People are the same.
The fact that this is set in a part of North London, and I think some of the contrast is around his behaviour with a quite well-behaved part of London that we see him often walking about, and then probably going into other people's worlds, slightly more dangerous worlds.
Yeah, he ventures into the underbelly of society where he wouldn't normally have gone because he had a perfect home life, and now he's looking for something.
And that's universal.
It's universal. People were confused when The Office worked around the world. It was shown in 90 countries in its normal state, then remade in 8. It's because it looked quintessentially English and parochial, but it wasn't. It wasn't. It was about characters. It was about people getting on and a boss they didn't like or wanting to be famous or becoming 40. It was all the issues were absolutely universal and global.
I was about to say The Office was remade in different territories.
Oh, that's so they could be more culturally relevant as well. And the only English-speaking remake was the American one. And that's because America, it's America. They want their own.
So that idea that there could be a kind of default mode of international humour, that's maybe some of the questions that we're asking as things go kind of super global. That doesn't trouble you at all.
No, because everything I've done has just accidentally gone global. You know, The Office around the world, Extras around the world, the first co-pro with BBC and HBO, the podcast around the world. Everything's around the world now because of the internet. What I don't do is try and make it for any particular demographic or country. I do it in English because that's the only language I can speak, and I write about what I know and what I'm passionate about, and people get it. People get it.
And that particularly sort of grim British humour, one of our columnists was writing, that also referencing some of your work, that he thought had something to do with a kind of joy in, or a perverse joy in, decline. And for some people, the background to Brexit is there on that question. Do sort of political considerations, big P, influence your work?
No, I don't. I keep politics, big P, out of my work. Just because if you're relying on an audience agreeing with you politically, you know, you might get a round of applause, but you've lost something comedically. And I think a joke should be able to be laughed at everyone from every walk of life and every demographic and every political persuasion. And we've seen recently that it doesn't mean anything anyway. I don't think there's no such thing as left and right anymore. It's no one looks at an argument anymore. They look at who's saying it. It's falling into sort of like just tribes of your for us or against us. And with this new thing of you have to agree with everything someone ever believed in or they're cancelled, you know, it's ludicrous. Most recently, John Wayne was cancelled for a slightly un-PC
the interview he did 48 years ago. So he had to try and think of what people in 48 years will think of his views.
But I think, in fact, you've covered yourself on that one, haven't you? You were tweeting that you apologised for anything offensive you might have said in the past and that you might say again in the future.
Exactly. All I can promise is you won't like everything I say, but I'm going to keep saying it.
You've also said that dogs, and perhaps only dogs, can save humanity. So I wondered, have you got a particular breed that you think could be our redemption?
Oh, the best breed is rescue. I think dogs are perfect. The last dog I see is my favourite dog. They're all amazing. They're beautiful. It's the closest thing I get to spirituality. I wish I could bottle dog. I go out every day to meet a random dog. It's my drug.
Ricky Gervais, on your dogs and drugs. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Cheers.
And we'd love to hear what you think. Are there limits to what can or should be laughed at? And what kind of mutt might just save the world? Write to us, radio@economist.com, or you can tweet us at Economist Radio. And please do take a moment to rate us on Apple Podcasts. You know David Brent would do the same. I'm Anne McElvoy, and in London, this is The Economist.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.